This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What's up with the Democrats? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Judge Samuel Alito was confirmed today to the U.S. Supreme Court. Tonight, President Bush gets the bully pulpit for his State of the Union address. For Democrats, the president's many weaknesses provide a moment of opportunity, but the Alito nomination showed how divided they are. Some call the failed filibuster a good idea. Others say it'll hurt Democrats in red states. Angry liberals are asking why a conservative Virginian was picked to respond to President Bush. On To the Point, we'll ask Democrats on the left, right, and center if compromise or confrontation is the best way to turn things around. We'll hear about the growing influence of internet bloggers on the party's Washington establishment. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To The Point. President Bush addresses the nation tonight in a politically weakened condition. But at this moment of opportunity, the Democrats are divided. On To The Point, is it time for a constructive compromise or for confrontation? We'll talk to Democrats on the left, the right, and the center. First, this news update. Samuel Alito is now Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He was sworn in almost immediately after the Senate confirmed his appointment, 58-42. David Savage covers the court for the Los Angeles Times. David, always good to talk with you.
Hi, Warren.
This was a very partisan vote, with Lincoln Chafee the only Republican to vote no and only four Democrats voting yes. How did it get to be so partisan?
Well, it's been, you know, heading that way for a number of years now. I don't think this really had a lot to do with Sam Alito and his particular views. I think the liberal groups and the Democratic groups wanted to take a stand on an issue and were troubled about the idea that President Bush would replace two justices with two conservatives, particularly Sandra Day O'Connor being a sort of moderate swing vote. And so they were determined to fight. And from the day Alito was nominated, you could pretty much guess that this was going to be something close to a party-line vote in the end.
Much more so than for the current Chief Justice.
Yes, John Roberts was such an appealing figure in his hearings, and I think he charmed a number of the senators. It's true he was also replacing William Rehnquist, the late Chief Justice, so he wouldn't alone move the court in any particular. He wouldn't move the court to the right. So to some degree, Alito had a tougher situation than John Roberts did.
You wrote today, again, David Savage in the Los Angeles Times, about the long campaign by people who worked in the Reagan administration as both the justices, Roberts and Alito did to make a more conservative court. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I think this is really the second generation of the Reaganites to come to the Supreme Court. When Reagan came to town in 1981, his lawyers in the Justice Department had a very strong ideological interest in judicial philosophy, the Supreme Court, more so than any Justice Department I know, any administration. They really cared about judicial philosophy. They wanted a more conservative court. Reagan wanted a more conservative court. And they not only sort of carefully selected people for Reagan to put on the court, they also brought in a lot of bright young conservatives and sort of promoted them through the Justice Department. Sam Alito and John Roberts were classic examples, one out of Harvard Law School, one out of Yale, conservative. They really got their start in the Reagan administration. They shared those basic sort of conservative views of that administration, and now a lot of Reagan's former people were instrumental in encouraging the Bush White House to nominate John Roberts and Sam Alito. So as I say, I think this is the second generation of the Reagan court.
One of those is still very much in the action, Ed Meese, the former Attorney General of the United States and a longtime Reagan supporter, appointee, staff member who came from Sacramento and was worked for him when he was governor.
Yes, absolutely. If you talk to people in the spring, Ed Meese and friends of his, And you said, who are the top picks? Who are your top picks? And who do you think the Bush White House top picks for the Supreme Court are? They always would say John Roberts and Sam Alito. I'd hear those names all the time. Some speculation in the press had other people, but the Reagan people were very high on Roberts and Alito. And with the, you remember that sort of sidetrack to Harriet Myers, but in the end, that's who President Bush chose, the people who the Reagan, the former Reaganites were promoting.
David Savage, once again with the Los Angeles Times. This is To the Point from PRI. One surprise, though, of course, Sandra Day O'Connor. She, too, was appointed by Reagan, and yet now one of the things the Democrats are complaining about the most is that she, a swing voter on the court, is going to be replaced by a man who appears to be a conservative. Is that an example of how presidential appointees can surprise presidents?
Well, O'Connor was to some degree. Anthony Kennedy certainly was Reagan's last appointee. He's replaced O'Connor as the sort of middle person who's going to be the key person. I think we must go into this thinking that Alito and Roberts are more conservative than Sandra O'Connor, and there's going to be sort of a new conservative block of Justices Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. But we'll see. You know, it'll be 5 years or so before we really know how conservative Roberts and Alito are. Sometimes they sort of move after they've been there a few years. And so it's always possible that, you know, a lot of the liberal groups fought hard against David Souter in 1990. Ted Kennedy spoke against him and voted against him. Souter's now one of our most, more liberal justices. So you never know for sure until they've been there a while.
Appointed, of course, by the current president's father, the first George W. Bush, George Bush, rather. We have a few cases coming up this year that might be instrumental. We have 15 seconds for you to tell us which ones they are.
Well, keep your eye on an environmental case, for example, in February about the Clean Water Act. It'll really determine whether the Clean Water Act applies to streams and wetlands all across the country. It's a big deal and gotten very little attention.
All right. We will be watching that and hopefully talk to you about that and other things as well. Thanks, as always, David Savage.
Thanks, Warren. Good to talk with you.
Again, covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a remembrance of Coretta Scott King. In a moment, what's up with the Democrats? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Ali back with To the Point. Today's confirmation of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court comes after a failed filibuster attempt by some of the Senate's most senior Democrats. Their effort appeared to be doomed from the start, and they lost the votes of many of their Democratic colleagues. Jim VandeHei reports on politics for The Washington Post. Jim, welcome.
Good to be here.
We saw the spectacle of Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts calling from Davos, Switzerland, on his colleagues at the very last minute to try to make an attempt at a filibuster, one that many of them, of course, said was doomed. It was a totally quixotic gesture, according to many. What happened? How did that come about?
Well, according to Kerry's aides, I mean, he had decided a few days earlier that this is definitely what he wanted to do, but once again sort of did it in a rather clumsy way. Several aides couldn't believe that their boss did it from Switzerland and then, you know, did it by posting on Daily Kos. They just thought that wasn't probably the best way to handle the situation. But there were, there's clearly a big division inside the Democratic Party over Alito and judges in general. We saw it in the Roberts fight, and we've seen it today on the Senate floor about whether they, how hard to challenge President Bush. And the activist wing of the party, particularly on the blogs, where I think you see, some of the most passionate Democrats trying to press their leaders to change course, believe firmly that there should have been a filibuster and that they should have found a way to sustain that filibuster with near unanimous Democratic support.
How did the blogs get to be so influential?
It's a mystery to me, and it's something, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, because it's not clear how large that community is. I think what the advantage they have is that it's instantaneous communication, and it's done in a way that it makes its way to lawmakers or to their staff, so people are reading it. There's several blogs that are very popular with both parties, but Democrats in particular, blogs like Daily Kos, where John Kerry had actually posted his announcement about filibustering Alito, and they seem to resonate. Now, the question is, how many people are on these blogs? Is it the same group of liberal activists that are jumping from blog to blog and posting sort of the same messages, or is this indicative of a much larger movement? And it's not clear. And I sort of hearken back to the Dean campaign, which I covered last time around. And early on, there was a point where there was a presumption that Dean was almost unbeatable because he was turning out these massive crowds, he was raising a lot of money, and the entire liberal activist wing that was active on the internet was behind him. But then when it came to Iowa, where you really need bodies to turn out voters, it wasn't as strong as it appeared at first glimpse.
Apparently, though, what they've managed to do is generate emails and faxes and phone calls, and as you say, they get to the offices of senators and I suppose congressmen as well. They're able to do that relatively quickly. Does that appear to be one of the major reasons, then, that the filibuster effort was made?
I don't know that that was one of the major reasons, but certainly it's a factor because senators, like representatives, respond to what their constituents are saying, and those constituents could either be in their state or they could be nationwide if you're a candidate who's thinking about running for president. And when you see a mass amount of communication, from the base of the party, and for someone like Kerry, who clearly is thinking about running again in 2008, he knows that to win those primaries, you need activists involved in your campaign that are going to knock on the door, stuff those envelopes, and try to bring people out to vote in primaries where voter turnout is very low. So there is an inclination and an interest in making sure that you're connecting with that portion of the party.
Is this comparable to what some people refer to as the Republican noise machine, which started a couple of decades ago with talk radio, direct mail, and that kind of thing, which was the technology of the day? Is the same thing happening to the Democrats?
I think so. I mean, I think there are a lot of parallels between what we see now on the Internet for Democrats and what we saw in the 1980s with talk radio for conservatives, in that you have, a relatively new medium that's being used for political purposes, and that it's being used by a group of people who sort of feel like they're not part of the process right now, that their voice isn't being heard. In the 80s, it was conservatives. They hadn't had control of Congress and literally in the House in decades, and they felt like the party wasn't responsive to its conservative views. So they used, talk radio to really push their message, connect with the grassroots, and try to move the party to the right. I think you see a lot of that now among Democrats, especially liberals, on the blogs, because this now gives them a voice and gives them a way to organize and try to influence the system in a way that wasn't, even possible 4 or 5 years ago. This is still, while the Internet's been around, as far as a political tool, it's a relatively new technology.
Jim VandeHei, a White House correspondent and a political reporter, in this case, for The Washington Post. As always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Good to be here.
He mentioned Daily Kos. We're going to have the man who manages that very popular liberal website on our program a little bit later, one of the major blogs that we're talking about here, influencing the Democratic Party. Jim VandeHei talked about the struggle amongst Democrats about how hard to challenge President Bush. And, of course, one of the things they have to decide is what are the major issues that are going to work for them. John Zogby is president and CEO of Zogby International, a polling firm. He's recently looked into this. And, John Zogby, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Very well. What are the issues, according to you, that in your polling that you think work best for the Democrats?
Well, anything that's on this side of the Atlantic, basically the economy, health care, Social Security, education, the environment. The problem, however, is doesn't appear to be much clarity coming from the Democrats on any of those issues. One possible issue could work for the Democrats. We have a poll out today showing that for the first time a plurality of Americans are saying, bring the troops home. We've done as much as we possibly can do in Iraq. There's nothing more that we can do positively, but the Democrats are tongue-tied on the war.
Well, what about the war and the notion of the national security in general, the war on terror, and the perception, at least, that the Republicans certainly want to push, that they're stronger on that issue than the Democrats are?
And the Republicans clearly are stronger on that issue, and every indicator points that way. And so what you have is the president stronger on the war on terrorism but weak on Iraq. The president has been able to utilize the war on terrorism to bring up his support, overall support, and support for the war in Iraq. Whereas in reality, what the Democrats are missing in terms of an opportunity is to utilize the failure on the ground in the war in Iraq as a way of driving down the president's numbers in the war on terrorism. Let's understand where the president's at today, Warren. My poll out today has him with a 46% job approval rating on fighting the war on terrorism. That's his highest number on any job rating. When he won re-election in 2004, it was 66%. So he's lost 20 points in terms of his approval rating on the war on terrorism.
And yet, back to this question of perceptions, the Republicans seem almost to be eager to have a debate about the National Security Agency and about the unwarranted wiretapping of American citizens and those questions about executive power that came up during the Alito hearings. Why are the Republicans so pleased to talk about that?
Because simply their polling numbers are high on that. They get near unanimous support among Republicans and enough independents and conservative Democrats whenever they link the eavesdropping, wiretapping, whatever you want to call it, with fighting the war on terrorism. Democrats have not come up with any credible plan in terms of spending more or targeting spending or more Homeland Security funding for underfunded areas like the major cities in the United States. Democrats just don't appear to have any credibility whatsoever on the war on terrorism. And so obviously you'll start with the president. Tonight's the opening salvo for two things. Number one, the president somehow getting his numbers back up just a little bit. And number two, the 2006 campaign.
Are the Democrats then well advised to stay away from national security as an issue?
I think actually they are, because as John Kerry should have learned, or Democrats should have learned in 2004, they just can't fight the campaign on the other side's turf. They have no credibility on it at all, and aren't saying anything to build credibility. Therefore, what they have to do is just simply change the subject and change the playing field. They win on domestic issues, and if they can ever gain some credibility by opposing, with their own base and with an overwhelming majority of independents in opposing the war in Iraq, they can also win on Iraq as well.
John Zogby, President and CEO of Zogby International. Eli Pariser is Executive Director of MoveOn.org, the political action blog that we know about that has been so influential of late. And Eli Pariser, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
What do you say to what we just heard from John Zogby? Stay away from national security.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and this also gets to what Jim was talking about earlier. I think more than coming from a particular political slant, what rank-and-file Democrats want to see right now and what Americans want to see is Democratic leaders showing strength, so showing that they're willing to take a position on principle and hold it, even when the political winds are blowing in the other direction for a time.
I think you misspoke then. You said a moment ago that you agreed completely, but with the idea of staying away from national... I think you meant you disagreed, didn't you?
That's right. I disagree that Democrats have to flee this turf. In fact, I think that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. As long as Democrats don't talk about foreign policy, they're going to be perceived as weak. And what they need to do is take the president on in a strong way for his failures in Iraq, for his failure in not catching Osama bin Laden, and show that they're willing to stand up to him.
So you're looking at confrontation then?
Well, that's right. I think the Democrats need to show the country what they stand for, and that means saying they disagree when they disagree and not following the poll numbers.
Again, we're talking with Eli Pariser. He's executive director of MoveOn.org. This is To the Point from PRI. Back to John Zogby, our pollster, quickly. What about this? Do the Democrats have a chance, if the president is as low as 46% on terror, to show some spine, I guess, is the way that we could paraphrase what we just heard from Eli Pariser?
sure. I don't disagree with Eli at all. Democrats must show strength. What they have to do, first of all, is define a position. And a position on Iraq is not what we've been hearing, which is, oh, we would have done it, but we would have done it differently or done it better. If they're going to take the president on in Iraq, what they have to do is stipulate, this was wrong, this was a mistake, we made a mistake, we see the light now, it has destroyed relations with countries all over the world, it has broken up alliances, our image is at the lowest point that it's ever been, blah, blah, blah. But barring that, barring the Democrats taking that position, what do they show strength on? Strength on the fact that, oh, we would have done the same thing?
John Zogby again, pollster. So Eli Pariser, back to you then. The Democrats, in order to be successful with the strategy that you're suggesting, have to do a bit of mea culpa.
Well, I think that I agree, and I think it actually it goes beyond that. I mean, let's remember for one thing that among both political parties, the only people who voted against the Iraq War were Democrats, and that's worth remembering. Not all of them have to do a mea culpa. But I think what people are looking for is a vision of what's next, what now? And with majorities of the American public and the Iraqi public saying, look, we need an exit plan that does this in a responsible way but gets the troops home in the near term, I think it's time for Democrats to find some unity and some leadership on that.
John Zogby, a pollster, what about the risk for Democrats in red states?
Well, they're losing red states anyway now, aren't they? But there are other issues that they can deal with in red states where the economy, where there's a high degree of economic anxiety. It's not only whether people are working or not, but whether or not they're afraid of losing their job, their health care, and now their pension, and so on. What about an expansion of Medicare, which should be on the table? What about a Medicaid crisis that's going on? These are red state issues as well as blue state issues.
Eli Pariser, a quick question for you before we need to go to a break, and it's this. The Alito filibuster effort was said by some that to be something that would injure Democrats in red states, and that's one of the reasons that the liberal Democrats who led the fight in the Senate got so few votes from some of their colleagues. What about that?
Well, I think ultimately the major task that Democrats have right now is to differentiate themselves from Republicans, to show what they have to offer the American people that Republicans do not. And I think one of them is their principled position going back decades on civil rights, on checks and balances, and on a number of the other issues that Samuel Alito is not very good on. And so I think, again, the thing that people are looking for more than anything is a position of strength, and it would have demonstrated strength if Democrats had filibustered Sam Alito.
All right. Once again, talking today about the Democrats and the moment of opportunity they seem to have as a result of the president's comparative weakness as he makes his State of the Union address tonight. We'll be back in a moment with Eli Pariser of MoveOn.org Political Action. John Zogby, thanks you very much for being with us. On Reporter's Notebook a little later, we'll have a remembrance of Coretta Scott King, who died today at the age of 78. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, our subject today, whether the Democrats, at a time which appears to be a moment of opportunity for them because of the problems faced by President Bush, the question, what issues, what stance, what political strategies are going to work for them best? They are now, of course, the minority party. Ed Kilgore is vice president for policy at the centrist Democratic Leadership Council, also writes the political blog NewDonkey.com. Ed Kilgore, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
The man that the Republicans have chosen to be the principal responder to the president tonight is Tim Kaine, recently elected as a Democratic governor of Virginia. But he's very much a red state Democrat. He is a pro-life Catholic. He's opposed to gay marriage. He's not at all the kind of core values Democrat that we hear being advocated by other parts of the party. Why is he the right one?
Well, I think it's for two reasons. first of all, he just won a remarkable election victory in a red state and did particularly well in precisely those rapidly growing suburban and exurban areas where Democrats have struggled in recent elections. And, you know, and remember, we are in a midterm election where we can't simply divide up the country into blue and red and, you know, make major gains in Congress and in governorships by conceding half the country. You know, and secondly, I think he's a reminder that, you know, there are Democrats actually governing out there as executives, meeting a lot of the challenges that the president and the Republican Party are failing to meet in Washington, you know, in doing so without this horribly polarizing rhetoric and political strategy of the Republican Party. So, I mean, I think he's a tonic for the troops and looking ahead to 2006. And, again, a reminder that whereas Washington may be controlled from one end to the other by a Republican Party that doesn't really know how to govern competently, you know, there are Democrats even in red states that are succeeding against the odds.
What do you say to those Democrats who say we need more polarizing, more confrontation, the effort to move to the center and try to appeal to conservatives has simply not worked? We've lost three straight national elections in a row.
Well, I don't want to get into left-center positioning talk. You know, I mean, I have.
Why
no,
not? Isn't that part of the strategy you need to consider for?
Well, it depends on your definition of the center, and it'd probably take us 20 minutes to get through that. I mean, the fact does remain that the Republican Party has chosen polarization as a political strategy. It's the only way they can win elections. Yes, we have to be an opposition party and meet that polarization honestly. And don't compromise our principles and fight, but at the same time, we need to do something more than counterpolarize. We're playing their game when we do that. We need to walk and chew gum at the same time, meet them as an opposition party, but show the country that we have a vision and an agenda that can lift us out of this kind of, you know, empty politics and empty government we have in Washington today.
Well, when you say vision and agenda on the one hand, and yet you have to, as I think you're saying, campaign differently depending on where you are, differently in a red state from what you do in a blue state, as suggested by the victory of Tom Kaine himself, isn't that inconsistent?
No, not at all. No, if you mean, does there have to be a lockstep Democratic agenda? Everybody has to sign oaths on every point of it. Of course not. We're a coalition party. We're a very diverse nation. But I do think generally across the Democratic Party, particularly on domestic issues, there's a great deal of unity in the challenges we need to meet and generally how to meet them. I mean, it's not too hard to show partisan differentiation here, by the way, with a Republican administration that, you know, frankly doesn't seem to think we have an energy independence problem, a health care crisis, a budget crisis, you know, an income crisis, an economic security crisis. I think Democrats are a lot more unified than some might think, and I don't think, frankly, partisan differentiation is our problem right now.
What about the filibuster effort, which did seem to highlight the differences between Democrats, at least as far as the vote on the filibuster was concerned? Obviously, they stuck together pretty much, only lost four votes in the final confirmation vote. But was that a good strategy, or was that something that simply dramatized their difficulties of getting together?
Well, probably as a strategy, it might have made sense if it had started a whole lot earlier. You know, starting a filibuster when you basically don't have the votes for it is a little questionable. But the key, when you say dramatize, the key question now is what Democrats do. How do we treat this? Do we focus on, you know, 19 Democrats voted, you know, for cloture, a term that nobody in America understands? Or do we focus on 40 Democrats, 40 Democrats voting against Judge Alito, which is kind of a high watermark at a time when Democrats don't control the Senate? We can focus on our unity. I mean, groups from the DLC across the spectrum opposed Alito's confirmation, or we can focus on, you know, divisions over a procedural vote. To me, it's pretty much a no-brainer. I don't want to take a name, the name of the organization, Eli's organization, but I think it's time for Democrats to move on.
Again, Eli Pariser, also with us, executive director of MoveOn.org, Political Action. Well, what do you say, Ed Kroger, to his insistence that particularly with regard to the war on terror and to Iraq, it's necessary for Democrats to get together in opposition in order to show that even though they are perceived as weaker than Republicans on national security, they are going to hang together on those issues and on the question of presidential power with regard to the warrantless searching and the insistence by the president that he has that authority, despite what people say about civil rights.
Warren, was that a question for me?
No, I'm sorry. It was a long, involved question, probably more so than it should have been. But I wanted to put the question to Ed Kilgore. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought so. No, I think we are fairly unified in suggesting that the president's kind of quasi-monarchical claims of constitutional powers to pursue national security is not only wrong but dangerous, and that, you know, going forward, certainly we have to fight the war on terror within the rule of law, which is actually one of the values we are supposedly fighting for, right? If I could return to the earlier discussion that I listened to with interest, I couldn't disagree more with John Zogby about the idea of changing the subject. We had an almost laboratory test of that in the 2002 midterm elections when Democrats did exactly that. It did not work. It didn't work back in the 1980s when Democrats pursued a similar strategy. For the foreseeable future, national security is a top issue. We have some credibility problems going back 40 years. So, yeah, we do have to reestablish our credibility on national security, and I definitely think we can. Now, let me just address Eli's point that we have to show strength. I do agree with that. But, you know, there are worse things than appearing vague or flip-flopping. It's taking the wrong position emphatically. I do think that Democrats, even though they're not heard often, are determined to robustly fight the war on terror, to track down Al-Qaeda, you know, to fight terrorism in other parts of the world, to recreate the kind of international organizations and alliances that give us genuine collective security against terrorism, to properly equip our armed forces. And when it comes to Iraq, I honestly think that if we don't get into the silly game of going back 2 or 3 years or 4 years and who was where and focus on democratic agreements on Iraq today, which I think are a lot stronger than people realize. I mean, you have some Democrats saying, let's set a deadline, but we can adjust it if circumstances dictate. You have other Democrats saying, let's don't set a deadline, but let's get out as quickly as we can, responsibly. I think Democrats need to focus on their unity, and I do believe we're unified in holding the administration responsible for how they got us into this war and how they've conducted it.
Ed Kilgore, Vice President for Policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, also writes the political blog newdonkey.com. One of the blogs we heard about earlier from Jim Vandehei, the White House correspondent for The Washington Post, one he said that has become very powerful and which is described by The Washington Monthly as having 3.7 million readers a week and having raised $500,000 for Democratic candidates last year, is Daily Kos. That's a very popular political blog on the internet. The person who founded it is Marcos Melitzas Zuniga. He's also co-author of a forthcoming book called Crashing the Gates, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Good morning or afternoon.
It is afternoon. Hard to keep track when you're on the computer all the
exactly.
time. I understand. What are Netroots?
Netroots are this new generation of party activists. It could be Republican, it could be Democrat, who really organize online. So it's not necessarily people you spend all their time online, but people who are doing their organizing online. So it could be everything from people who read blogs and participate in blogs to people who participate with Move On and people who work with Democracy for America and any of these other organizations that do their organizing online.
Why do you think John Kerry chose your blog, Daily Kos, to post his intention of creating a filibuster?
Honestly, you would have to ask him. I mean, and there's some irony there because actually Daily Kos has been one of the more hostile places to John Kerry in the past. So, but the fact is that it has the largest audience, I would assume. But, I mean, for better motivations than that, you'd have to ask him.
Why have you been hostile to John Kerry?
Daily Kos, in a lot of ways, and a lot of the Netroots-focused blogs, really, during the 2004 primary season, focused more on the Howard Dean and the Wesley Clark candidacies than they did on John Kerry. There's a very much perception or feeling that it's an insider versus outsider type of environment. And most of the Netroots practitioners really feel like they're on the outside and they're trying to essentially crash the gate and burst into D.C. And people like Dean and Wesley Clark are seen as outsiders, and people like John Kerry are seen as insiders. So that generates a lot of the hostility.
What do you think the outsiders who participate and read your blog want to see as far as Democratic candidates are concerned? It's my understanding one of your principal focuses is to get Democrats elected.
No doubt. I mean, it's a very, in a lot of ways, very non-ideological type of environment. I know that Republicans are trying to paint me and my audience as left-wing radicals and even some people within the party trying to do that. Reality is that we are very much pragmatic. I mean, we realize that Democrats aren't going to be a majority party if they sit there and engage in battles over who's centrist and who's liberal and who's conservative inside the party, that we're going to need all types of Democrats to win in different parts of the country. So it's a very pragmatic outlook. We'll look at somebody like Ben Nelson in Nebraska who votes with Democrats 48% of the time, and we nod our head in agreement because he's in Nebraska, and 48% of the time is better than we'll get if he's replaced by a Republican. So that's not the issue. It's not moderate conservative. The issue that we're looking at, though, is we need Democrats to be Democrats, to not be afraid of the party, to not run from the party label. And I think we have a party that's been conditioned over the last couple decades in an environment that has been very hostile to liberal voices from both the media and political establishments, that they're afraid to be strong Democrats, and we want people to be strong Democrats. That doesn't mean be liberal. It means stand, be proud of the party you represent.
What does it mean in terms of words like polarization and constructive compromise and the kinds of arguments we hear about what they mean in terms of strategy and how it comes down with people who seem to be tired of what they see as partisan gridlock in Washington?
Well, it's kind of hard to talk about partisan gridlock in Washington when one party controls all three branches of government right now. The White House, both chambers in Congress, and the Supreme Court are all controlled by Republican or Republican appointees. So I'm not quite sure where the partisan gridlock is coming from. Now, we have a party, the Republican Party, that can't govern to save its life. And so if people have problems, you know, they need to look at the reason that the country is under problems. It's not because of gridlock. We can't gridlock. We don't have that capability. We showed that yesterday with our inability to even filibuster a very radical right-wing judge.
You said that you were happy with Ben Nelson. He's at least a Democrat 48% of the time in a red state, and yet he's still a Democrat. But you're, as I understand it, encouraging a Democrat who's running against another incumbent, Joe Lieberman, in Connecticut. Why are you doing that?
Joe Lieberman is somebody that we're calling a Fox News Democrat. He's a Democrat that the media reaches out to when they need somebody to criticize Democrats, a Democrat criticizing Democrats. That's his entire reason of existence at this point in life. And so you have somebody like Ben Nelson who will do the Sunday morning talk shows, and you'll have hosts asking him to criticize the Democratic Party, and he absolutely refuses to do so. He remains loyal to his party, even if he cannot vote with them 100% of the time because of local political concerns. Joe Lieberman, on the other hand, thinks he's he thinks he's a maverick, but he's essentially become typecast as a Democrat who will criticize other Democrats. And if he was representing a state like Nebraska, that might be tolerable, but he represents a state like Connecticut, which is a solidly progressive state, and the people of the state probably deserve better. So at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the people of Connecticut to decide what they want, but it's really telling that in poll after poll, most of Lieberman's strong support comes from Republicans, not from Democrats.
Marcos Melitzis, again, the founder of Daily Kos. We'll be back to you in a moment. First, let's go back to Ed Kilgore at the Democratic Leadership Council. Mr. Melitzis is website is said to represent a very important potential core of voters for the Democratic Party, young liberal professionals who want to hear a tough talk. What do you say to what we're hearing, and particularly the distinctions being made between support for Ben Nelson and support for the opponent of Joe Lieberman?
Well, you asked two or three questions there at once. I certainly agree with Marcos's definition of the Netroots. I think it is a legitimate part of the party that's growing, that's been given an enormous new technological megaphone. I do think you have to kind of distinguish between the different functions of the Netroots. There's organizing, there's fundraising, there's influencing media, which I think is a very, very, very important part of the blogosphere, left and right and center. And then you have you know, agitation on particular issues at particular times, and I don't think we should throw all those together. And frankly, I think the blogosphere is a resource for the party as a whole that is likely to grow in the future, and I personally welcome it. In terms of the whole question of what's a good Democrat, and you know, Ben Nelson versus Joe Lieberman, I mean, I would agree with Marcos on this, and I've said this a thousand times. The only people that really have the right to say who's a good Democrat and who's not are primary voters in every state. And if Connecticut Democrats want Joe Lieberman or don't want Joe Lieberman, it's totally up to them. I do think, however, the focus on Lieberman, who, aside from his views on Iraq, doesn't really go on Fox Radio and criticize Democrats and has a very progressive voting record, more progressive than many on issues like health care and taxes, you know, is a myopic view of the political landscape and probably a waste of resources for national Democrats. Connecticut Democrats want to do something about him, that's fine. But if it becomes some sort of national Netroots cause, or whatever you want to call it ideologically, I think is a waste of resources and shows an excessive focus on Iraq.
Let me go back to Marcos Melitzis on that. Your response, if you will.
Well, it's Connecticut Democrats that are driving the opposition to Joe Lieberman. So the idea is to support those efforts and create a, I mean, you know, Kilgore says Lieberman doesn't go on Fox News and talk and trash talk about Democrats. He does. And we have a record of him doing this over and over again. And it's quite interesting because earlier this year there was talk about Lowell Weicker challenging him, and he actually went underground for 4 or 5 months, and that talk died off. And it was only recently that he started doing the rounds again, criticizing Democrats on issues like Iraq, that really, really inspired Connecticut Democrats to find an alternative to him.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. Ed Kilgore said you're focusing too much on Iraq.
Well, it's one of the key issues. I mean, if you're going to talk about what we're going to focus on, obviously Iraq is going to be one of the driving issues of this coming election. So, yes, obviously it's important. Now, we have a Democrat who doesn't really, you know, Kilgore made a really good point earlier. He said that Democrats are fairly well united on the issue of Iraq. The vast majority are realizing that we need to find a solution to the problem and get out as quickly as possible. Lieberman isn't one of those people. Lieberman's one of these people who goes around claiming that everything's going great, that everything's fine, to the point where Times bureau chief in Baghdad had to stop at one point. And he said in a radio interview, "I don't know what country Lieberman's talking about. It's not the country I'm living in right now." So,
okay.
So that's the issue at the end of the day. But it's not the only one. I mean, Iraq, we have plenty of Democrats in the caucus who take more Lieberman-esque positions on Iraq. The issue is loyalty to the party and going into forums and criticizing other Democrats.
Well, it's fun to talk to all of you, and please do come back and talk to us again. Again, Marcos Melitzis is founder of Daily Kos, Ed Kilgore is with the Democratic Leadership Council. We also spoke with Eli Pariser of MoveOn.org Political Action, John Zogby, the pollster, and Jim Vandehei of the Washington Post. Thanks again to all of you very much for being with us today. Coretta Scott King died today at the age of 78, and she's remembered as much more than the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. We'll hear why in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point, and we were hoping to go to Reporter's Notebook, talk a bit about Coretta Scott King, who died today. Our guest for that purpose at the moment is not picking up the phone. I'm told that he is coming in a moment. So let me then introduce the subject by saying this. Coretta Scott King went from a segregated rural Alabama to the New England Conservatory of Music, and she had planned to become a classical singer. But she met and married that young minister from Atlanta, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and her life, of course, was changed forever. Once again, she died today at the age of 78. We do now have with us Dr. Claiborne Carson, a professor of history at Stanford. He was named director of the Martin Luther King Papers Project by Coretta Scott King. And thank you very much, Professor, for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
Tell us a bit about her. You worked with her personally over a long period of time.
Yes, I think that she was a great woman, someone who built a major institution to carry on the King legacy, the King Center in Atlanta. Someone who played a major role in bringing about the King holiday. I don't think there would be a King holiday without her dedication and tireless efforts. someone who played a major role in the Free South Africa movement, being arrested at the South African embassy and as part of the campaign to change American policy relative to the apartheid government there. So I think she has a lasting legacy of things that she did in her own right, as well as in her supportive role during Martin Luther King's lifetime.
Do you think it was a surprise to a lot of people when she went from that very supportive role after the assassination so very quickly into being, as you pointed it out, an advocate and a crusader, if you will, in her own right?
Well, I think particularly at that time, I mean, you know, we're talking about the late 60s at a time when most American women, or most women throughout the world, played supportive roles, very few of them public roles. So for the widow of Martin Luther King to emerge in her own right was I think, fairly revolutionary at that time. You know, I think most people would have expected her to be kind of like Jackie Kennedy, who, after John F. Kennedy's assassination, withdrew into a private life and raising her children. And I think no one would have begrudged her if she had done that. But instead, she launched on a career that has ended up lasting far longer than the time that she had with Martin.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Claiborne Carson, who heads the Martin Luther King Papers Project and is a professor at Stanford University. Didn't Dr. King himself have a rather traditional idea about women and the role of women? Is this something, do you think, that she sort of chafed under, and was she, in a certain sense, in a limited sense, obviously, liberated?
I think that to a certain degree that was the case, although when I looked through the the letters that they wrote to each other when they were courting, I mean, it was clear that there was a meeting of minds. They were not only deeply in love with each other, but they had a passionate commitment to peace and social justice, which was just very striking even during the days when they were dating. So I think to a degree they were traditional in the sense that Coretta played the more supportive role, staying home with the kids, but I think also untraditional in the sense that they both had this this tremendous concern about issues. They wouldn't have come back to the South if they had not both agreed that that's where they needed to take part in the emerging civil rights struggle.
There were reports from time to time of womanizing by Dr. Martin Luther King. Some of his opponents tried to use that against him. Were those things very wounding for her?
I think that her feeling was that what she saw of him, she obviously liked a great deal. She did not believe many of the rumors. Whether at a deep level she did know that it was happening, we might not ever know. But I think that she understood that the important thing was that they had built a life together, and they had children together, and they had these deep commitments to bringing about positive change in the world. And that was far more important than whether or not he occasionally strayed. I mean, those are the
sure.
things that happen in many marriages, as we well know with public figures.
Sure. And public life obviously has a very high price for people to pay. Dr. Carson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, director of the Martin Luther King Papers Project and professor at Stanford University. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Radziner and Kristen Bordahl, technical director Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.